Thank you. Well, I also would like to thank the organizers for asking me to speak, and thank you very much, Linda. And I will take offense at King Corn. Like, oh, that's not fair to all those other important crops. Okay, here's my question. I want to compliment the first speakers. They're very, very nice talks and really exciting progress for people who are interested in nutritional quality of staple foods, really fun things, very good talks. I'm not talking about you, Kevin. I mean, younger people, the somewhat younger. Oh, and so you must have thought about what this compound may or may not be very quickly. And is there any progress on that? Do you have any idea what?
Not really, but we just got a new water Zevo G-tube Q-top. So assuming I can find someone to help drive it, we ought to be able to figure this out.
Great. Well, good luck on that. I'm going to fast forward, actually, because since we had such very good talks, especially this last talk, defining the CAECO 2 model system. But I'm going to come back to my talk, but I have a few slides at the end. And I'm going to fast forward to one that I want to show you that was the CAECO 2 study of some of our materials, just to illustrate something. Very interesting that you don't see much variation in phytic acid in your population, which is understandable in a basically wild in terms of phytic acid population, but do see such a big difference in iron availability. Very exciting. Here was a CAECO 2 analysis of near isogenic lines that Ray Glahn did with us many years ago, actually, now maybe 10 years ago. And since we have such a nice background in this for the folks who are here, I don't need to explain very much other than to say that the four bars that we have here, this is a wild type maize. And this is that same, and this is the CAECO 2 assay model. That same maize with ascorbic acid, which is a which gives a benefit in iron retention in the CAECO 2 model. And this is a near isogenic line that is low phytic acid 1, which has about a 60 to 70% reduction in phytic acid. And you can see that using the CAECO 2 model, there is an enhancement in iron availability, bioavailability, equivalent to the enhancement you see with a wild-type maize with ascorbic acid. And then here is the low phytic acid plus ascorbic acid. And I've always really liked this result, and you see this additional benefit in iron bioavailability. My initial instinct in seeing the result, Owen's results, is that there might be things going on here that we don't quite understand concerning iron bioavailability. But really, this kind of result, and of course other studies, we've had studies with a low phytate maize and other crops with human subjects, which show a benefit in iron retention due to reduction in phytic acid. So I guess what I might say is I look forward to the kinds of materials that you might produce could go a long way to, you know, figuring out bioavailability, really, when you think about it. So now I'll try to go back to my actual talk, which is going to be just a general talk about the work that we've done having to do with phytic acid content in seeds, both our stuff, low phytic acid genetics, but also work with phytase enzymes. Folks here might know phytase is an enzyme which breaks down phytic acid, and there's been a lot of work with phytases, largely due to the interest in phytic acid as a phosphorus, as the major phosphorus compound in seeds and in animal nutrition, improving phosphorus retention in animal nutrition. So let me begin by saying that from my interest, it's definitely human nutrition, but much more broadly has to do with phosphorus and both the total amount of phosphorus and its chemistry in seeds are important in animal end use, in end use quality, not just animal, human also. You know, I got reminded of a study in Owen's talk, not a study, a story. When I started 25 years ago, about 20 years ago, Pioneer Hybrid. Now, the bulk of Pioneer's corn hybrids is fed to pigs. And it was about in the mid-1990s, maybe 15 years ago, when I started working with them, or early 1990s. And at that time, they had not evaluated their hybrids in pig feeding trials. And you'd think this is what their product is used for. You'd think they would do a bunch of studies with pigs to see if they liked one corn hybrid or did better with the grain from one hybrid versus another. And this you reminded me of this because there could be, you know, variation out there, which greatly impacts end use quality that wasn't observed because they simply weren't looking. What were they looking at? Yield. And this was always the conflict that I had in my work. Yield is king. What about quality? But there's no room for quality issues in agriculture, and at least in the United States, because if you yield is everything, that's what the farmers get paid for, is how much grain they deliver to the, you know, the silos. But think of all the variation that's possibly out there. At that time, they weren't doing any such evaluations to see if pigs did better or liked better one hybrid, grain produced by one hybrid versus another. Of course, they weren't also doing studies at that time concerning, nutrient use efficiency in feeds, you know, waste management. They weren't thinking at all about that. When we first started doing our research, just the idea of collecting feces and testing feces, you mentioned what goes in, what comes out, you know, that was like, oh, that's a kind of an ugly subject. We're not going to talk about that or even deal with it. But that was 15 years ago. So anyway, I'm going to focus on, without telling too many allegorical stories, phytic acid, that part of the seed phosphorus having to do with phytic acid and our low phytic acid mutations. You know, phytic acid represents about 3/4 of the total phosphorus in seeds. And to make this relevant in agricultural production, the amount of phosphorus packed into seeds of grains and legumes each year is equivalent to more than 50% of the total amount of phosphorus applied as fertilizer worldwide. So if you think about it, that's a lot, that's a big fraction of phosphorus in ecological flow in agriculture. More than 50% of the phosphorus applied as fertilizer worldwide ends up in grain, and a significant fraction of that ends up as this one compound, phytic acid. And that's kind of what I'm very interested in, and we're interested in total phosphorus genetics, but I won't have a chance today to talk much about that. Applied interest in phytic acid has to do with nutritional quality, mostly, at least in the U.S. and in Europe, having to do with phosphorus management in agricultural production. And I'll talk a little bit about that, but also human nutrition. When I started my PhD work in this area, we were interested in the human nutrition question. So anyway, phytic acid binds very tightly to mineral ions, iron, calcium, magnesium, zinc, and it forms salts. Phytic acid is the most efficient chelator of iron known. So it really very effectively binds iron. That's why studies like those at Cornell are so interesting to me. Phytic acid binds these nutrients in the intestinal system and is excreted, and this process could both reduce the retention of iron and zinc and calcium by a human or a pig or a chicken or a fish, but also, of course, reduces the utilization of phosphorus that's in the feed. And there has been a lot of interest in that. So grains and legumes are a poor source of available phosphorus, and consumption of phytic acid can contribute to water pollution. This is what I'm going to talk about now a little bit. This bar graph here is what a normal corn or soybean seed looks like. This is phosphorus fractions. This is just a cartoon about, it's actually about, for grains, it's about 3 mg/g total phosphorus. For legumes, it's more like 4 or 5 mg/g. But most of that is phytic acid phosphorus. There's a little bit of inorganic P, and the rest is DNA, RNA, protein, etc. And we've isolated a bunch of low phytic acid mutations that block the synthesis or accumulation of phytic acid. And what these largely do is they reduce the phytic acid, increase the inorganic P. The net result of this is that the available phosphorus is greatly increased in these grains as compared with wild type. I will say in passing, although I'm not supposed to talk about this, that we do have a mutation, at least one gene, which affects the total amount of phosphorus. It's a low phytic acid gene in barley, but it also affects the total phosphorus in grain, reduces it by 15%. We're quite interested in that. Also alters the distribution of phosphorus and minerals in the grain, which could be important. Now, to summarize the animal and nutrition study, because I'm going to talk mostly about yield in the next 10 minutes and field trials, but our low phytic acid crops, there's really been a lot. We produced acres worth of this stuff. We first started working with Pioneer, and we produced acres of, we created near isogenic hybrids, produced acres of the stuff, and low phytic acid, normal phytic acid, lots of nutritional studies with maize, barley, even one with rice, which I should have thought of bringing a slide. I meant to, but I'd make a slide about it, but I didn't. Study with rice, low phytic acid rice, soybeans. So there's been a lot of new animal studies and human nutrition studies, and this summarizes the results. The consumption of the low phytate types does translate it to increased available phosphorus for animals, humans as well. You know, an interesting story in passing for those interested in human nutrition. At a talk at a symposium many years ago in enhancing the nutritional value of crops, I talked about how these low phytate types have high available phosphorus. And that could be of benefit if there's a human population that's subsisting on grains and legumes. They also need a high, you know, available phosphorus. Phosphorus is very important to bone mineralization, etc. And one of the organizers got up and said, "That's ridiculous." Said, "Phosphorus deficiency is not an issue in human nutrition." So, I guess it's not an issue in human nutrition. But from my perspective, if there's a population that's subsisting on grains and legumes, phosphorus availability's got to be an issue in addition to everything else. But anyway, that's an aside. These studies, the studies of the low phytate crops, have also shown a very linear and inverse relationship between the phytic acid levels in foods and feeds and calcium, iron, and zinc nutrition. So I'm summarizing a lot of work in this one slide, but numerous studies with human subjects and numerous animal subjects, weanling pigs, all kinds of studies have shown clearly that you get about a 30 to 50% enhancement in iron, zinc, and calcium retention in the low phytate versus normal phytate types. So basically, reduced phytate translates into enhanced mineral nutrition. I guess I said that, summarize that down at the bottom. Now, this might be a little bit much for you guys to see, but I wanted to summarize where we're at, and if I spend the rest of my time in this one slide, that'd be fine. It's a lot of information. I don't know if you guys could read it, but this summarizes where we're at today. I left out a couple of crops that people have done work with, and I want to make just a point. If you see here, if you could read this, first, what I call first-generation breeding and versus second-generation. First-generation, what I'm trying to say here is first-generation is where you cross in an allele, and you have a low phytate line and a normal line, or any trait for that matter, and you do studies. You know what that reminds me of? I was going to make sure I shut off my phone before I gave it to him, but that's not my phone ringing. Anyway, second generation is where you actually do breeding, recurrent selection, like Kevin was talking about earlier. And, so people have that's not been done with the low phytate types yet, too much, a little bit. I'm going to talk about that. That is where you might have a line that's homozygous low phytic acid, and you select within that line for yield or stress tolerance, and you probably could then get a better yielding low phytate line if you do this sort of recurrent selection. Maybe I'll get to that at the end. Some very interesting studies having to do with the impact of recurrent selection, the epigenetic impact on recurrent selection, really cool stuff. So in terms of resources that are out there today in maize, we have recessive alleles at 3 loci, I believe, so far. I won't go into the genetics too much of this. They reduce phytic acid anywhere from 50 to 90%. I haven't seen, despite the fact that these have been around for a long time, the results of recurrent selection, not just crossing these things in and looking at yield, but breeding with these things. There are transgenic types in maize. Pioneer identified the gene that was perturbed in low phytic acid 1, which was a transporter, and then used it to transgenically alter phytic acid content, targeting it to the embryo of maize. Paper came out in Nature Genetics a few years ago. And then there's the introduction of phytase. This was the work done actually at Cornell. They actually transformed maize with an embryo-targeted phytase, if I remember correctly. And it also had the ferritin gene. So they introduced the soybean ferritin and a phytase enzyme into maize. And actually, that result I showed earlier with the CACO2 study that we found that there was a larger benefit to simply reducing phytic acid than to transgenically introduce fungal phytase and ferritin in terms of iron bioavailability. We've really made a lot of progress with barley. We have lots of genetic resources in this area with barley, perhaps because that's what I've been mostly working on these last 10 or so years. We have at least four loci in barley. We've done breeding. I'm going to show some yield trials. We have barley cultivars, which in our yield trials yield as good or better than the best yielding non-regular phytic acid barley cultivars. That could be exceptional to barley because, you know, for crops people out there, if there's any barley folks here, barley is tough. You know, if the world needs to have a crop to subsist on, barley's the one. It's tough. You know, maize is mamby-pamby compared to barley. King maize, you know. Barley's tough. But we have really great stuff with barley, and we have a lot of studies I'll talk about. There's stuff in wheat and rice. Soybean, I'd like to eventually get down to this phytase gene in soybean. Very interesting work. And then more recently, common bean, that's phaseolus. My Italian colleagues have isolated a low phytic acid mutation in common bean, and they claim that it has a pretty good yield characteristics. But one thing I have to say to summarize this field thoroughly, that when people do yield trials, when people evaluate the productivity of a type, of a low phytic acid type, sometimes they just grow some plants in the greenhouse or in the field, and oh look, they grow pretty good, and they say, oh look, this guy's good. But to do careful yield studies in multiple locations with the proper controls, near isogenic types, to really stressful versus non-stressful environments, that kind of stuff, that hasn't been that much work actually with this. So I'm quite cautious. I've seen people talk like this maize, the work done by Dr. Shi at Pioneer with the maize transporter gene, and in Nature, they said that it grows pretty good, you know, and so on. Well, we've grown some of these things out, and they haven't looked too good. So one needs to be careful. I'm going to skip over that for time. For example, this is one of the most thorough studies that I've seen, one that I participated in, complimenting myself. Actually, Phil Breggers did this. This is four sets of near isogenic lines, each set consisting of a wild type and a low phytic acid gene. So these are pairs of sibling near isogenic lines, and they range in phytic acid reduction from 50 to 90%. And they were grown in several environments over 2 years. And if you look at the yield data, what you can see is that the yields of the low phytate types are quite comparable with the yields of the sibling wild type types in the irrigated or non-stressful environments for most of these, with the possible exception of this most extreme mutant here, this M955, but we saw a yield effect in the irrigated or non-stressful environment. But if you go to the dry land that's non-irrigated, and these were quite stressful actually in those years, drought, we had a drought out west for 5 years. This is right in the middle of this horrible drought that we had that lasted for 6 years, and it was a very stressful environment. And then you can see that with some of the lines, you still don't see much of a yield effect. But as you move down this table, you see a greater and greater effect of the low phytic acid in the stressful environment, quite a significant effect. So I would say with the phytic acid types, as well as any novel germplasm, that you have to be very careful when you start talking about productivity and yield. You know, you need to do careful studies. You need to consider how these plants perform in stressful environments. I love that carotenoid stuff. I'd like to see some of the very interesting, see some of that stuff evaluated like this in these sorts of careful studies. Here's a result from this year. In my colleague Phil Breger, so these are barleys, that I found that the highest yielding line cultivar he had, this is a line, the highest yielding line he had of any barley in the yield trials this year was in fact a low phytic acid line. So if you've, this one that's right at the top, because this is ranked from high to low, and this is a low phytic acid type that has about a 70% reduction in grain phytic acid. So if you read a review article in this field that says that there's a generic assumption that the low phytate type will have reduced yield, I would be hesitant about that, because you know, the expression that I use is no bucks, no Buck Rogers. If you work on breeding for yield, you might be able to develop a low fight day type that has high yield. She's threatening me. But, you know, I've been around longer than her, but not much longer than her. Did I just say that? Very interesting soybean. I'll skip all this stuff because I want to just go to something at the current status, and I'll conclude with this to save us a minute of time. So, to summarize, nearly all the past work has been simply crossing in low phytic acid alleles and or introducing a phytase enzyme with no subsequent breeding. Even with minimal breeding, there's some good yielders. But what really I think is interesting, what we're wanting to do, is to do recurrent selection. To select within a low phytic acid population. I'm just thinking about how to set this up to do it right, preferably with and without stress. And I want to conclude with a mention of this very interesting paper. I don't know if folks here have seen this, but I don't know how to pronounce it properly. Halbin, I think would be the way, et al. In PNAS, where they did a very simple recurrent selection within canola. They took leaves from a double haploid canola population. They took leaves and measured a respiratory rate. And because there's an inverse correlation, low respiratory rate, high energy use efficiency. They simply did this simple recurrent selection, picked the five lowest respiratory rate plants out of 200, repeated it five times, and discovered they had an enhancement of yield of 5 to 20%. Very simple recurrent selection. Then they looked at whether it was genetic versus epigenetic, you know, a simple assay for DNA methylation versus molecular markers. And they found that it was almost, they attributed entirely to epigenetic change. And that immediately struck me as an old graduate student from the University of Illinois, the Illinois high and low protein lines, that a lot of the change resulting from epigenetic, from recurrent selection in any program could be largely epigenetic. We focus on genes, et cetera, but really the epigenetics is important, I guess that's all I'm saying here. And I'd like to see some of that done with the phytic acid stuff. And I'll conclude there. Thank you very much. Do we have to go to the end to get to the black screen so they... None. Go ahead.
Okay. Do you have any issues with emergence in your barley?
We haven't noticed that with barley. I skipped over those soybean line studies. A very interesting work with soybeans. Not with barley we haven't noticed, but with soybeans, very interesting results. They do see an effect of the low phytate genotype with emergence, germination and emergence in soybean. This could be a legume versus grain difference, maybe not. And they actually, there has been some recurrent selection. That's one of the examples where there has been some breeding work done to try to identify lines which do better than the low phytate trait in soybean. And they made some progress, apparently, they claim, colleagues at Iowa State University. Very interesting phenomenon with soybean that they found with two genes, not just one, but two. They found a seed source effect. That if the seed biologists here, if there are any besides me, there might be, you know, they found that if they produced the seed in a tropical environment, Puerto Rico, and then grew it in a temperate or tropical environment, that the low phytate trait had a much larger effect on had a huge effect on germination and emergence compared with wild type. If they grew that same genotype, if they produced the seed in a temperate environment, they didn't see that effect. So the seed maturation in the tropical environment versus temperate, big difference between the low phytate and normal type. We haven't seen that with barley. Any other questions? Please. Go ahead.
Can you explain to me your last sentence about the epigenetic effect in recurrent selection?
Explain how it works, or?
What do you mean by it?
Okay. What they did was, and I'll speak quickly so that we can get out of here. You know, epigenetics is the methylation patterns, and what they did was is they used basically an assay for cytosine methylation. They used the cytosine methylation AFLP assay, and what they saw was is that the line selected for respiratory rate that they observed just in five generations, large changes in respiratory rate, which they could correlate with yield, but that the changes could be, they could detect inherited differences in the methylation patterns as assayed by methylation-sensitive AFLP. I don't know if this is answering your questions, they're rather technical. Whereas if they just did, if they did just regular old AFLP, they didn't see. So they concluded that it wasn't classical Mendelian alleles, you know, sequence changes, that they concluded it wasn't sequence changes, but the epigenetic state, the methylation pattern, that was changed. No, this is AFLP. This is mapping of methylation. I can't remember exactly whether it was just methylation or whether they also looked at the histone patterns, et cetera, but I think it was the methylation. I hope that answers your question. You were raising your hand.
I'm going to ask you a break.
Okay.